Welcome to Richmond Law and Policy's podcast series. Richmond Law and Policy is a social justice law firm specializing in consumer protection class actions, representation of nonprofits and progressive businesses, and civil rights litigation concerning police misconduct. Our first season gets to the core of systemic issues regarding factory farming and is intended for educational purposes only. Hi everyone, this is Jack with the Richmond Law Group, and today we will be continuing our series on CAFOs and their harmful impacts on communities and the environment. I'd like to welcome our interviewer today, Maria Payan from the Socially Responsible Agricultural Project, who will interview our guest and longtime colleague, Dr. Sacoby Wilson. Dr. Wilson is a professor at the University of Maryland and is a known voice in the environmental justice community. Dr. Wilson will now walk us through what makes a CAFO a national security threat.
Dr. Wilson, thanks for agreeing to be interviewed. I am particularly interested in your views of CAFOs being a national security threat. I never thought about that too much, and I doubt that others have. So can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, I think if you look at CAFOs, so if you can go from, so these concentrated animal feeding operations, you know, by definition, there's a large number of animals grown in a small confined space. So you can go looking at industrial chicken farms, industrial hog farms. You can even look at other types of animals, you know, cattle feedlots as well. So the reason why I frame them as a national security threat for multiple reasons. First, they do not have the proper waste management technologies on site. So if there's a natural disaster, for example, a catastrophic hurricane that ends up flooding those facilities, the berms break, the waste from facilities, for example, from industrial hog operations, that waste can run off into rivers and streams, killing fish, basically destroying the water quality of local rivers and streams, impacting the well water of local residents. Most these operations are located in rural areas. Most folks in rural areas they're on well water. So their primary drinking water supply is coming from well water. That well water could be impacted in two ways by these operations. You have recharge, so in the aquifer can be contaminated due to leaching, and then the runoff itself. So we have rivers and streams, which are an important part of our economic engine, which are important from a tourism standpoint, which are important from people who hunt and fish, they're important culturally. Those are national assets. Those are important local assets. So for me, when you have these facilities, they're basically biological bombs, right? You talk about dirty bombs. These facilities are dirty bombs that are not regulated. If you think about if these facilities were regulated like they should be under the Clean Water Act, many facilities that discharge into the rivers and streams, like industrial hog farms, for example, I think also maybe some chicken farms, they don't have an NPDES permit, a National Pollution Discharge Elimination System permit. That's one problem. They are not compliant with EPCRA, Emergency Planning Community Right to Know Act. Most industries that are emitting a certain set of chemicals above a threshold annually have to report their emissions to the air, water, and soil. For some reason, these industrial facilities don't have to. So how are local folks going to know what they've been exposed to? How is it impacting their human health? How is it impacting the environment? So again, the reason why it's a national security issue, partly because of the waste management technologies, the waste management infrastructure, they are not up to par with other industries that are in sensitive geographic locations. Also, if you think about folks who have been impacted, they have underlying social, economic, and geographic vulnerabilities that make more risk from the emissions from these facilities. So whether it be air quality impacts, ammonia, hydrogen sulfide, Baltic organic compounds, particulate matter, whether it be chemicals that get into the water like nitrates and the impact on human health, whether it be bacteria like E. coli, Campylobacter, whether it be MRSA, resistant bacteria. They're resistant to antibiotics. Or would there be viruses that could be transferred, zoonotic diseases transferred from those animals to humans? Those are all human health threats. Those are all environmental threats. Those are national security threats, in my opinion. So if someone wanted to devastate a region of the country with, you know, biological waste and contaminants, they're also soft targets. So not only by the nature of the poor management system, the infrastructure, are they dangerous for human health, but by themselves, they are soft targets because they are not using the proper security measures and technologies to protect themselves from interests that may, you know, terrorists or other types of parties who may want to do harm to those facilities. So it's not just that the security threats themselves, they could be threatened because they're soft targets, okay? And so in my opinion, why isn't Homeland Security doing more to help the EPA and USDA and Department of Interior protect the homeland? Our natural resources, our water, our, you know, our rivers and streams, air quality. I mean, think about this. You have a worker who could be, for example, in a situation where they're working on the farm and they get exposed to some resistant bacteria, or maybe they get exposed to SARS-CoV-2 virus. Think about the devastation that it has for that worker. But again, from the Homeland Security perspective, our economic interests have also been impacted. So we should do more to make sure we protect communities that host these facilities, and also doing more to protect our workers. COVID-19 hit, workers working in processing plants were already working in poor conditions. OSHA had already dropped the ball. So if Homeland Security came in and said, we have to do more to make sure that if there's an outbreak, we can contain the outbreak. And think about how the outbreak of COVID-19 has actually impacted agricultural workers, processing plant workers, impacted their families. If that's not a Homeland Security issue, then why do we even have the Department of Homeland Security?
Right. So following up on that, what can be done in terms of policy to highlight this? Because I don't think this has ever been discussed. Not in this past.
Yeah, I mean, so you look at hurricane, for example, in North Carolina. Hurricane Floyd hit North Carolina in 1999. It devastated the industry, right? It devastated the animal agricultural industry. You saw a lot of animals that died in the floods, pigs and chickens. Hurricane Florence hit a few years ago. Hurricane Florence dumped 11 trillion gallons of rain. As a hurricane, right? A lot of the rain impacted eastern North Carolina. Places were flooded out. Again, these factory farms were flooded out again. Okay. So when you think about policy perspective, Homeland Security and FEMA should be working together to make sure that these facilities, first, get out of the floodplain. Second, that they have actual technology for waste management. Having a pile of chicken litter, chicken crap, is not technology, is not waste management. Use the backhoe to dig a hole in the ground to store a liquid hog waste is not technology. We have to make sure they're actually using sewage treatment systems the same way we treat human waste. We should be treating hog waste. We should have a different storage process for chicken litter. We should focus more on regenerative agriculture instead of this factory farming approach. Just in some ways, we need to, you know, transition away. We need to have a just transition away from this type of factory farming because it is a national security threat. It threatens the economic structure of rural communities. It threatens the cultural fabric of rural communities. It threatens traditional, true family, authentic family farming. It exploits workers who in many ways are sharecroppers, immigrant workers, right? Latinx immigrant workers from the Caribbean and other parts of the world. It's a form of economic exploitation. So how is this not a national security issue? So I would say, you know, remove the current waste management practices and make sure they're upgraded. You know, if you think about the economic sort of potential and the economic needs of this country, we have to invest in our children who are going to be the next generation of workers, right? And so how can you have these facilities in areas where kids are being impacted by exposures from the chemicals? The larger issue is we need to just transition from factory farming. We need to move back to true sort of family farming. We need to invest in other types of sustainable agriculture. We have a broken food system, both in the U.S. and globally. We have international, transnational corporations who are owning many of the large pork producers and chicken producers. And that's having a negative impact on folks who live in the U.S., both economically, socially, and environmentally from a health perspective. So we need to have a just transition from these type of operations. And we need to make sure that they get any tax breaks, corporate welfare. We need to take that away from them. Take that money away and invest it in true family farming.
I couldn't agree with you more there. Yeah. So this is going to lead us into something that I know we both are very passionate about and deal with consistently within communities. And you mentioned right to farm laws. We know that these operations are becoming so big now in comparison to what communities were facing even 20 years ago, especially when we're talking about environmental injustice communities where they often locate these facilities. Talk a little bit about right to farm laws.
Yeah, it's interesting. Many states in the country basically protect the industry because they have these, you know, right to farm laws. So it gives, so we're basically classifying these factory farms, these industrial level farming as farming, but it's really not farming. So a right to farm law should be protecting true family farmers. And so what happens is because of right to farm law, they basically get exempted from other laws. In addition, it creates restrictions on how local governments and counties can actually basically govern how these facilities operate. So, you know, if you want to put in a new health ordinance, because of the right to farm law, it's not going to apply. If you want to put in new buffers, right, you know, distance between this facility, the facilities and sensitive human receptor sites, like schools, like daycare centers, like residential areas, you know, these right to farm laws basically exempt these facilities from having to comply. I mean, in many cases, it makes sense to have right to farm laws because many rural communities, they are agricultural, right? But when people talk about agriculture, and at least in a traditional sense, they're not talking about these vertically integrated, large, multinational producers who are supporting, basically creating environments where you have a large number of animals being grown in a small confined space, and the impacts on the community are, you know, sort of horrendous. From public health impacts, as I've already said, from economic impacts, people's property values are impacted. You know, the value of homes go down. Research has shown this. Research has shown all the negative health impacts. I mean, there's so many things that could be done with farming, like true farming that's more, again, more sustainable, more regenerative, produces more jobs, has less impacts. That's what the right to farm law should be doing. But instead, the right to farm laws are protecting these industries from really having to comply with environmental regulations. And then it's allowing them to continue to expose their impacts to others. So these social, environmental, and health externalities, if there's like true cost accounting, and then it's just like the host communities, it's the folks who work on the farms, or even the people who actually have farm, who are basically running the farms. It's like a sharecropping system. If there's any type of negative impacts to the environment, like a spill or something, that farmer has to absorb the cost. The corporate integrator gets away scot-free. So it's just not the local communities that are impacted, but it's also the folks who run in the farms are impacted too. And so I think that right to farm laws, they need to be revised. I know Senator Cory Booker has a law he wants to, a bill he wants to push that puts a moratorium on all CAFOs. And I believe he also wants to over time, some of these waste management practices that are really dangerous, you know, detrimental to human health and environment, remove them all.
So that's gonna, we talked about challenges with the siting and the right to farm laws and environmental injustice communities. But BIPOC communities also face unique challenges in the siting because of literally a lot of contamination that they're dealing with. Can you expand upon that a little bit?
Yeah, so you think about why we call this an environmental justice issue. Well, many cases, these facilities, whether it be industrial hog farms, industrial chicken farms, cattle feedlots, they are disproportionately sited or disproportionately, you know, located in lower wealth communities. In many cases, those lower wealth communities may have more people of color, so more Black folks, more Latinx folks. So in some of my work that I did in Mississippi, and some of the work that we've recently done in Delaware, some of the work that Dr. Steve Wing did, looking at the distribution of industrial hog farms in North Carolina, and also some of the work that we've done in Maryland as well, we see disparities in the distribution of these factory farms based on race, ethnicity, based on income, and also based on educational attainment. And in Dr. Wing's work, as I said earlier, we also see these facilities disproportionately located in places where people are in well water. So you have that. Now, the contamination, again, you can have chemical contamination. So think about contamination of the air from volatile compounds. They burn your eyes, nose, and throat. They can mess with your mood. Some VOCs are also cancer-causing agents. You have particulate matter. PM is like the dust in the air. So think about the feathers, the animal waste in the houses, and then the chicken litter itself particleizes, right? Becomes windblown, and that material can blow into your house. So you know it can cover your car. It can cover your yard. You're out there minding your business, got your clothes up on the lawn. If you're still doing that old school, your clothes on the lawn, and your clothes can get covered by that fecal material, right? You can be gardening, and the waste can cover your garden. You can have the waste cover the walls of your house, and of course there can be intrusion of the waste of the dust into the house, and so. You got fecal material, right? So you have biological agents. Again, you have E. coli. You have, other bacteria. You can have viruses that people are exposed to. But if you think about the air pollutants, VOCs, particulate matter, hydrogen sulfide, the rotten egg smell, ammonia, all these things can impact respiratory health. It causes asthma. Particulate matter itself can cause asthma attacks, can cause stroke, heart disease. Impact infant mortality, cause birth defects, low birth weight babies. It's been shown to contribute to diabetes, Alzheimer's, it impact life expectancy as well, lead to premature mortality. So you've been exposed to multiple chemicals in that plume that comes from these operations. And if you're drinking contaminated water, you can be exposed again to so in the air, you can be exposed to bioaerosols. So you've heard about COVID-19, the SARS-CoV-2 virus can be in an aerosol. So it's just not the chemicals in that aerosol, in that plume of air. It's also this virus that you've been exposed to. And then you think about the water, well water, right? So you've been exposed to chemical agents, again, like nitrates, other things that are found in the fecal material, because, again, you have runoff or windblown material that can get into well water. You can be exposed to bacteria again. So think about GI illness for folks that have been exposed to E. coli, Campylobacter, and maybe even some other pathogens as well. So you've been exposed to both biological contaminants and also chemical contaminants in the air, in the water, And again, if you are gardening or you're doing your own farming, you can have windblown materials, whether it be from the spray field when you're spraying waste or from the chicken litter pile, that gets into your garden and on your farm. And so that means on the surface of those vegetables, on the surface of those crops, on the surface of those fruits that you're growing, you also have waste, animal waste you've been exposed to. That's, to me, that's treating people inhumanely when we are not doing our best to protect them from industry. And this is an industry. In the same way, coal, fire, power plants, you know, fossil fuel industry is an industry. In the same way, folks who manufacture products, plastics, you know, petrochemical corporations, that's the industry. In the same way, you may have factories in the community that emit pollution to the air, water, and soil that's regulated under the Clean Air Act. This is an industry too. And it's an industry is getting away with not complying with environmental regulations. And it speaks to, in many ways, it's not just environmental justice. We're talking about environmental racism, right? We're talking about environmental classism. You're targeting poor areas. You're targeting communities that are unincorporated in many cases. They don't have a town mayor. They don't have a town council. So they have no political power. So it's contamination without representation, right? And so because you don't have the political power, you don't have the economic power, or you don't have the complexion for protection, as Dr. Robert Bullard would say, because you're Black or you're Latinx, then you are at risk of being exposed to these chemicals through the air, water, and soil, and having these adverse soil, by Mississippi, and having these adverse health effects, right? But I'll stop there. We always joke with the Ariana and Natasha about my Mississippi accent coming out in certain words. That's one word I say. I prefer to say dirt.
So this is going to bring us into, you mentioned the health impact assessment that we had done in Delaware. You had done for a community that we were working with here. And this community was already impacted, the study had brought out, through things like power plants, concrete plants, spray fields, Superfund sites.
Veterinary medicine?
Yes. Merck animal agriculture they do.
Yeah.
Yes. So they were getting dumped on, per se, from a lot of different impacts from a lot of industry.
Yep.
And when we talk about this community in particular, but this again goes throughout nationally, what people are dealing with, cumulative impacts is something that seems to be off the table when we're talking about siting these facilities. So, the other thing was the lack of transparency that we found in Delaware. Expand a little bit on what really is very problematic with that.
Yeah, so if you think about the planning of the chicken processing plant in Delaware, I think one of the issues is, and just kind of going through this concept of cumulative impacts first, it's really problematic, in my opinion, when you have a community kind of becomes designated as the dumping ground. I've been in conversations recently. You never hear about wealthy communities have to deal with these type of industries. It's almost like they're off the table. Wealth is like the laws are set up. So the environmental rules and regulations, they don't even worry about them not being complied with because it's an automatic. So when you think about cumulative impacts, we're talking about multiple local and one land uses being dumped into the same community. So in a rural community, you can have a community that hosts a landfill, that hosts a catfish factory. I'm talking about Uniontown, Alabama. So this is a community we work in. Hosts a landfill, the landfill's on top of an old plantation cemetery. They host a catfish factory. They host a cheese factory. Well, and what's interesting there, part of the community is unincorporated. And it's like assumed they're supposed to get the bad stuff. You know, working with folks in Delaware, right, in the community they already had the brownfield, the Vlasic Pilco facility, right? They had a coal-fired power plant. They had all these other, they already had a chicken processing plant nearby too, right? And so it's interesting how, to me, our federal regulatory schema, even though earlier I said, you know, we need to make sure, you know, there's enforcement and compliance, our federal regulatory schema have failed communities that we're talking about. Why aren't the USDA, the EPA, the FDA, Department of Interior, the Department of Transportation, Department of Health, why aren't they doing more to protect rural communities? Why, when a facility, if it is going to be permitted, in some states, these facilities don't have to get permits, right? These factory farms don't have to get permits. Why isn't there a recognition that you have to understand the cumulative load that these facilities can have on a local community? And so you're exactly right that it's just not factory farms that are being placed in these communities. They're being hit from multiple angles by different types of industries. So we need to figure out a way to integrate cumulative impacts analysis into what the EPA is doing, what the USDA is doing, but also give power to local governments and county governments that have more authority to use cumulative impacts as well. We want to put a moratorium in our local jurisdiction on these factory farms. The counties and local governments should have the ability to do that using cumulative impacts analysis. Additionally, you know, from an EJ angle, Title VI of the Civil Rights Act talks about disparate impacts. I'm sorry, so many rural communities have been disparately impacted by this industry, again, as relates to environment, as relates to human health, and also economic opportunity. Because this industry, in many ways, it kills your ability to attract non-pollution intensive industries. It puts a damper on property values. It impacts cultural tourism. It impacts ecotourism too. It impacts people who are living off of hunting and fishing, okay? So I think it's important. And then when you get to the Delaware, get back to the Delaware example with the processing plant, and just in general, there's a lack of power that folks have, at least it seems to have the local level. There's a lack of transparency in like the process of how the state agencies are engaging with these corporate integrators. And you know, they know in advance there's gonna be a new farm put in place, but then local neighbor doesn't know. One day the farm is example like using in North Carolina, it's a tobacco farm. The next day, you got a eight-house hog farm.
Tell me a little bit. I know you had a little bit of participation with the communities. Well, a lot of participation, I know, with the communities there. And for people to understand with these communities, when we're talking environmental racism, you're talking decades that these folks have been exposed. Can you talk a little bit about your involvement in
North Carolina? Yeah, so early in my sort of training, as part of my training in grad school, I worked with Dr. Steve Wing, who unfortunately passed away 4 years ago. He did a lot of work on confined agricultural feeding operations, primarily industrial hog farms in North Carolina, working with concerned citizens artillery. So Gary Grant in the early mid-90s, working with Naeem Muhammad, Black Works for Justice. And then eventually Gary and Naima, they started the North Carolina Environmental Justice Network in part to really look at these issues around environmental racism and the siting of industrial hog farms in North Carolina. I mean, two of the largest producers of hogs in the country are Duplin and Sampson County. Duplin County, these counties have a large population of Black folk. And then Dr. Wing actually did a really interesting map a few years before he passed away, where he showed enslaved Africans in 1860, a map of where they were in North Carolina, and showed a map of where all the CAFOs are in North Carolina. And you look at the color change, right, where you had a higher percentage of people who were enslaved in 1860, you also showed a higher number of these industrial hog farms. So what passes prologue, right? You have racism baked into our policies. Many of those enslaved folks, after they were free, they moved into the floodplains. They moved into swampy areas, right? And, you know, where are a lot of the hog farms at? In those same places. And again, these type of uses get put in place where people don't have power. People have economic power, don't have political power. And so that's environmental racism when you think about how these facilities have been primarily put in people of color communities. So that was part of my work, you know, early on in my career as a grad student. And I really learned how to work with communities, doing community-engaged research, you know, looking at the impacts of the industry on human health. You know, Dr. Wing was primarily looking at, exposures to contaminants and how it impacts human health, how it impacts mood, how it impacts your immune functioning, how it impacts asthma. My work was looking at ammonia levels near industrial hog farms and looking at the spatial gradient as you move away from the hog farms, you know, looking at changes in ammonia levels, and then how, you know, their exposure disparities for folks who may go to churches near these farms, people who went to schools near these farms. And so what's important about that work in North Carolina, it really shows the importance of race and racism in our environmental policies. It shows the importance of race and racism in our agricultural policies. I mean, we talk about, you know, we want to preserve family farming, right, in this country. I mean, think about the plight of the Black farmer. Part of Gary Grant's story is that he was part of the Pickford lawsuit against USDA. Black farmers not getting loans, right? So you've been impacted by industrial farming, but then you are a historic Black farming, Black community, freedmen community, settlement community, and then you had your family land, you can't even get loans. So that's part of the story too, about sort of racism in the system. It's not just where these CAFOs are, it's about how we are supporting farmers and who can get loans and who's not getting loans. The same way you see racism in housing policies, right? And, you know, redlining of communities, it's the same. We've had redlining in farming, right? And that's part of the story too, when you think about foreign policy. So foreign policies that support industrial ag and foreign policies that support, that's racist-based, loan policies where Black farmers and other farmers of color have been able to keep their farms up. And so how are you going to bring a new generation of farmers when you have racism baked in the system where we're not really saying, hey, because of your skin color, you can be a farmer, you know? So I think that's maybe a little tangential, but I think that's part of this story too, of why we have to eradicate racism in agriculture.
We talk about, okay, Black farmers unable to have opportunity. We talk about corporate welfare, right? We talk about communities that want to build positive communities that want to keep traditional, what most people feel is traditional agriculture strong. I know farmers who literally have to take their animals to states in order for processing because this vertical integration has eliminated a lot of what we need to invest in. So what do we need to do to change this system? So we talk about environmental racism. We've known there's been environmental racism for decades. Yep. Now we're at a point where we've all had a lot of time to think about it, a lot of time to get on Zoom meetings, right? And talk about it. What is being done to change it? And what do we need to do?
I think to change it, I'm just going to keep saying, if we go back to some of the things that we talked about in the Right to Harm documentary, I think there were some really important solutions that are outlined there. I think this focus on regenerative agriculture is really important. Sustainable. What does sustainable agriculture look like when you have equity built in? So sustainable agriculture, right now, factory farming, industrial animal agriculture, that is not sustainable because you have these externalities. So we have to get rid of these negative externalities for it to be called sustainable agriculture. And the regenerative agriculture, I think we need to see USDA, I mean, the next farm bill, we need to move away from subsidies. That's part of the solution, right? We need to move towards investing in communities, investing in eco-agrarian communities. So my thing is, if you talk about the food, energy, water nexus, Because, again, a lot of folks in rural communities, they're dealing with a multitude of sort of chronic health issues and health disparities, right? Economic disparities, social disparities. Folks don't have access to healthcare. There are folks, I'm from Mississippi. Mississippi is an agricultural state, right? But why does Mississippi have the highest obesity rate in the country? You have some of the highest obesity rates in the country in rural states that have a lot of agriculture because people are not engaged in agriculture themselves. So we need to, from a training education standpoint, we need to make sure that we're training, educating people in regenerative and sustainable agriculture. That's a focus on equity. We need to be working with land grant institutions to move away from big ag, because a lot of land grants, they have conflicts of interest. They get a lot of funding from big ag. They get a lot of funding from companies that focus on pesticides. They get a lot of funding from companies that do vertical integration. We need to get land grant institutions funding. We need to incentivize training in regenerative sustainable agriculture. We need to incentivize them doing agriculture in a different way. As I said earlier, we have a broken global food system. We have people in the U.S. We're supposedly one of the wealthiest countries in the world. Why are people starving? Why do we have food insecurity? Why are people hungry in our country? Because we got to bring farming to them. So rural agriculture and also urban agriculture. I'm a big proponent of urban agriculture. So we need to change the way we do agriculture and have the farm bill drive that. If we keep incentivizing poor farming practices, if we keep incentivizing corporate integrators, we're going to keep getting the same results that that's a form of insanity. So how can we push our politicians to do better? Well, first, you got to vote. You got to vote for folks who are going to support sustainable regenerative agriculture. You got to vote for folks who are going to fight for food, security. We have food apartheid in this country. We focus on food sovereignty. Invest in family farms. Create food co-ops. So you don't have to go down the road two states away to the processed blend. That, people are really getting, it's like, what's it called? Farm to table? I mean, those people are like, oh, farm to table. No, we're talking about building, kind of going back, old school is new school. Changing the way we have farming communities. We produce more jobs when it's more of family-based farming, right? Because all the support industries. So you got people who are doing the processing, people who are doing the marketing the products. You can market organic products. You can market various types. Think about just the opportunity to do more comprehensive, more holistic community building where you think about food, you think about energy, you think about water. I would like to see more rural co-ops that focus on agriculture but also bring in water and energy. That's the way how we build new community ecosystems.
I'm going to bring us back to the health impact assessment that was done in Delaware. And there was something like a FOIA request in Maryland. They call it a PIA request. And I was absolutely appalled when in this request was DPI, which is a trade group for the industry, basically writing to the governor of Maryland, as well as the dean of the university, because you did a public health study, a health impact assessment in Delaware. And I think that a lot of people do not understand the pressure to get independent science and the pressure that's put on public health researchers. Talk a little bit about that.
No, thank you for that. Yeah, so a few years ago, it's actually been, is it 4 or 5 years now? Has it been 5 years?
Probably, yes.
Well, yeah, so we were working on this HIA, and then like the trade group in Delaware, they sent a letter of concern, I'll just say it referring, a letter of concern to the governor of Maryland, to I think the chancellor, to the governing board for the university system, to the president of the university, to the dean of the School of Agriculture, and the dean of the School of Public Health, asking, why is the School of Public Health in Delaware doing a study on public health issues in Delaware?
Against the economic of the poultry industry.
Yeah, I guess a public health study that showed there's some didn't put the chicken industry in the best light, and it's interesting. It reflects a larger sort of issue when you're talking about independent science. These companies, these industries have so much power. A lot of folks on the boards of these universities, they're corporate members. You may have representation on a university board from these industries. These people are friends with each other, right? This leads to creates conditions or climates where independent science is not valued. If you're not doing science that supports the industry sort of message, then you're saying it's been anti-industry, and in my case, chicken farming. I'm not anti-farming. I'm pro-community. I'm not anti-farming. I'm pro-family farming. I'm not anti-farming. I'm pro-sustainable farming. And so as a scientist, I'm going to make sure that I do work that a community has concern about a plant. I'm going to follow the scientific method and collect the data and present the facts and provide some recommendations. But unfortunately, a lot of science that's being done at land-grant institutions, because of the power of the agricultural industry across different parts of it, they tend to shy away from work that will put those industries in a negative light. My mentor, Dr. Steve Wing, was at UNC. He had a similar situation happen from the North Carolina Pork Council. And they wanted to get the addresses of folks who participated in his community engaged research study on industrial hog farms in North Carolina. And the university was actually trying to force them to give it up. People lost their jobs. He was not protected by the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And so you see this happen time and time again, how the power industries to threaten scientists. And also, it's just not threatening scientists. These industries have threatened residents, have harassed folks, have intimidated people. We've had examples of police officers who are part of the industry team intimidating folks in North Carolina. A prime example, one of my community mentors, Elsie Herring, her neighbor was a hog farmer, came in and accosted her mother, physically assaulted her mother, right? And so you have these examples time and time again of intimidation, harassment of community members, and intimidation and harassment of scientists or universities because of the power of the industry and because of their own conflicts of interest, because they're taking monies from these industries that they tend to not support public health studies or support studies that put these industries in a bad light. And for me, that letter was concerning because I hadn't gotten tenure at that time. And so, I risked, it's risky for your career when you're at a land-grant institution doing work where your work is showing that, this industry is having a negative impact on people. But again, because I'm a social justice researcher, environmental justice researcher, it's important for me to make sure I stand my ground, because the work that I'm doing is providing voice to the concerns of folks on the front line of fence line who are dealing with, CAFOs.
Right. I'm really glad that we're talking about this, because I think it doesn't get spoken about enough. And we're talking about science, right? We're not talking about ideology. We're talking about science. One of the things, and I'm just amazed every time a community, we're putting in comments, we're helping them with comments that calls. The American Public Health Association put out a position statement at the end of 2019 calling for a moratorium on CAFOs. This is the American Public Health Association. This is not, some type of fringe group. And the fact that agencies that are in charge of giving permits and doing this don't even know this is concerning to me.
Yeah, it's really, so I'm a member of American Public Health Association. I actually helped to co-found the Environmental Justice Committee of the Environment section of APHA. And it's really important that APHA put out that statement because these operations are having detrimental effects on, again, on the environment and human health, and also the economic stability of these host communities. And I believe that it's really important for science to be done. You know, we need to have rigorous science done to really understand the impacts of these facilities. The facts are the facts. These facilities emit pollutants that impact human health. These facilities emit pollutants that impact the environment. These facilities, research has shown these facilities impact property values. I mean, even some really innovative research has been done on the microbiome, like by Dr. Chris Haney, that they can track genetic markers of bacteria found in the guts of hogs and in the guts of chicken and in the guts of cows. And if you find that fecal material on your house, on your windowsill, you know, on your floor in your house, you know, in your kitchen, up your refrigerator, in your bathroom, that's trespass from a local facility. What APHA has done has been really important. I think the work of groups like Food and Water Watch is really important. SROP is really important. Social Responsible Agriculture Project. The work of REACH, North Carolina EJ Network, is really important. You know, the work of the Center for Livable Future at Hopkins, really important. I think the work of the IETP, there's some other groups that are doing work on this issue. We need to have science being done with communities on these issues so we can document the problems and, again, translate that information to action. And I think we talked about some of the solutions. Without science, independent science, we can't improve the lives of these communities that host the facilities or improve the lives of workers who work on the farms, workers who work in the processing plants, and workers right now, because of the lack of good science, the lack of good protections, are being devastated by COVID-19.
I want to just close it up with thanking you, because what you have brought to communities is invaluable, and they don't have access to. And you talk about the value of various organizations. And I think, you know, I heard you say it a long time ago. You do research, you do a white paper, but what good unless the community, right, takes a hold of that and engages. And that is the way to changing policy and to having a true participatory democracy.
Exactly. Which
is what we're supposed to have. And your work is very valuable and it's very appreciated. So I just want to thank you every day for all that you do for the communities.
Thank you, Maria. Thanks for this opportunity.